statement followed by a few words of welcome. And so consistent with my own Anishinaabe cultural teachings, it is important to introduce myself in relation to the world and in relation to the lands that we occupy and are situated on now. So I'll introduce myself in my own language and then I'll proceed with the acknowledgement. So Bojo, Kwekwe, Semakwe, Dishnakas, Makwa Dodem, Temiagaman, Anishinaabe. In short, I'm telling you who I am and where I come from, and I've given you actually quite a bit of information about myself in my own language and about my own role and my own path in life. The English translation doesn't do justice to the full scope of the Indigenous languages, but briefly, I come from northeastern Ontario, from the Temagami Anishinaabe. My traditional name is Tobacco Woman, which is one of the four sacred medicines in our culture, and I come from the Bear Clan. Those of you who know anything about the Anishinaabe teachings know that my work in equity and social justice is probably tied to the fact that I do come from the Bear Clan. So in many Indigenous communities, we understand our relationships to one another through these formal introductions. And we also typically then acknowledge the people of the land we are visiting. And I've heard similar introductions across the world at many events and many conferences I've attended. And I've come to understand the importance of acknowledging people and the land, especially importance in terms of reclaiming culture, tradition, and identities that have been impacted by colonization. And they're also important about asserting self-determination. So when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission released its 94 calls to action here in Canada in 2015, many organizations across the country started the practice of acknowledging Indigenous lands at public events and at different kinds of gatherings, at board meetings, etc. And in some instances, there's been some pushback related to that in terms of it's been criticized as a kind of a tokenistic gesture and one that we simply seem to be reading off, which is why I've gone into kind of a longer kind of introduction of myself and situating myself in terms of the land. And it's in my own view that this is really critically important, that these acknowledgements are more meaningful, heartfelt, and move towards a better understanding of Indigenous people. So I don't profess to have all the answers. Some days I wish I do, and I think some days people look at me like I do have all the answers, but I don't. But I do share these as thoughts, my own personal thoughts, and as starting points. As I acknowledge the peoples of this land, I ask you to think about a couple of things. To think about what the land acknowledgement actually means to you and to your organization, to the university or the department or your work that you're doing. I encourage people and institutions to reflect more deeply and ask important critical questions about Indigenous peoples of the land, the history, and the current context. Personally, I try to learn as much about traditional peoples of any land that I enter and I find myself visiting. So while I'm Indigenous to lands in Canada, I also acknowledge that I'm a visitor here in this land of Tuckeranto. So I respectfully acknowledge that these lands have been cared for by the Anishinaabe Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and the Huron-Wendat. I also acknowledge the current treaty holders of this land, the Mississaugas of the Credit of First Nation, and that this territory is the subject of the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, an agreement to peaceably share and care for the Great Lakes region. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to be a visitor in this land and to live and also to work here in this territory. So this particular speaker series, the Global Label Labor Speaker Series, provides an important opportunity for us to engage on issues relating to global issues like labor. So we are fortunate, and I feel really blessed to be a part of the York community now, that we have here three of the seven co-editors of the Equity Myth, Racialization, Indigeneity at Canadian Universities. Luann will introduce them shortly, but I do want to acknowledge the work that the co-editors did on this important book. So we have three, Dr. Francis Henry, Dr. Carl James, and Dr. Ina Dua, and I want to thank them personally for their contributions. I've relied on their book in my own work, but I've also recommended it to a number of my colleagues as well. And to the moderator of the panel, Dr. Shireen Shah-Ropney. Thank you also for being here and joining us as well, and I look forward to discussing more with you about your own work. The equity myth is nationally recognized, and I would probably say internationally recognized as important work because it was one of the first comprehensive database studies of racialized and Indigenous faculty members' experiences in Canadian universities. For those of you who work and carry out research on racialized and Indigenous people's experiences in the academy, you'll recognize that this work is still very relevant. My own research on documenting the experiences of Indigenous students and professors in post-secondary education intersects with many of the key aspects of the equity myth. This is an important opportunity for us to reflect on the lessons learned and critically reflect on where we are today with respect to bringing about change in the academy. Events such as this is also a wonderful opportunity to network, meet new people, make connections with people doing similar work. On a personal note, many of you here are aware that I recently joined York in the inaugural role of Equity, People, and Culture. This newly formed division is to support the growth of equity and work towards a more positive organizational culture. No easy task at any institution. But one that I am looking forward to working towards a culture here at York University that's more equitable, inclusive, respectful, and healthy. I look forward to what promises to be a very informative panel, and I want to thank everyone for joining us here today. Niguech, thank you, merci.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here today. So it was only about 2.5 years ago that this landmark collaborative study on racism in Canadian universities was published in the form of a co-authored book entitled The Equity Myth, Racialization and Indigeneity at Canadian Universities. The research reported in the book draws on a rich body of survey data and interviews to examine the everyday workplace experiences of racialized and Indigenous faculty members across Canada. The data reveal that the policies and diversity initiatives undertaken so far have only served to deflect criticism of a system that's doing little to change itself. Now, this is an old story. Efforts toward diversity and inclusion fail to go beyond representation in social systems that are exclusionary by design. Without system change, certain individuals and groups are drawn inside, but to devalued and dispossessed places. This is the essence of social exclusion. This is indeed an important topic that differently affects all of us engaged in the university. So we're very pleased to have with us today three York authors of The Equity Myth. They will reflect on how their work has mobilized equity efforts at York University and in institutions across Canada in the past 2 years. They'll also consider whether and why certain themes or concerns and questions have garnered response while others have received less engagement. So I'll introduce each of our distinguished panel members and our discussants for today's discussion. First of all, Dr. Francis Henry is Professor Emerita from the Department of Anthropology at York and is also a fellow of this Royal Society of Canada and the Canadian delegate to the Women for Science at the Inter-American Network of Academies of Science. Francis is considered to be one of Canada's leading experts in the study of racism and anti-racism. Since the mid-70s, when she published the first study of attitudes towards, quote, people of color, she has consistently pioneered research in this field. Notable books include The Equity Myth, The Color of Democracy, and Racism in the University, Demanding Social Justice and Inclusion. Dr. Carl James, also a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and professor here at York, holds the Jean Augustine Chair in Education, Community, and Diaspora. He's also the Affirmative Action, Equity, and Inclusivity Officer. He teaches in the Faculty of Education and the Graduate Program in Sociology. An educational background in sociology, his research interests include examination of how race, ethnicity, gender, class, and citizenship intersect and mediate opportunities in education and employment for racialized and marginalized youth. Dr. Ina Duoff is Interim Director of the Center for Feminist Research and Associate Professor in the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York. Her research covers the historical construction of the categories of nation, race, and gender in Canada, immigration processes, women and health, equity and anti-racism policies, and the racialization of masculinity and femininity, globalization, and biodiversity. Her notable publications include Scratching the Surface, Canadian Anti-Racist Feminist Thought, The Hindu Woman's Question, Decolonizing Anti-Racism, and Theorizing Anti-Racism, Linkages in Marxism and Critical Race Theories. And finally, our discussant, Dr. Shirin Shakrokni. Shirin is an assistant professor in sociology at Glendon. Her research explores racial inequities in the realm of education. Her coming book, to be published with Routledge, examines the experience of upward educational mobility among France's descendants of post-colonial immigrants, looking in particular into the effects of everyday racism and institutional practices of exclusion on their academic and social experiences in France's elite higher education institutions. She's currently one of two co-investigators on the Shirk-funded RACE project, which examines the racialization experiences of international students from India, China, and Korea across five universities. Her work has been published in Ethnic and Racial Studies, the British Journal of Sociology, and the Journal of Ethnic and Migration Studies. So welcome to each one of our panel members and to each one of you, and thank you for agreeing to lead us in this discussion today. So what we have planned is that the panel members will each present for a total between the three of them about 45 minutes, and then Shirin will offer comments and begin our discussion time together. We will reserve time for questions and your comments before we conclude at 3:30. So I turn the floor over. Oh, the sign-up sheet. This is always reminding me. This is Eva Spoking, the coordinator of the Global Labor Research Center. We do like to know who comes to our events. This is useful for us. And if you wish to be connected to the Global Labor Research Center and our speaker series, please provide your email address for us. Steve, you're motioning. What are you? Seats. Thank you. Okay. There are some seats on this side. So now is a good time to come around. Yeah. Please come and sit down if you wish. Yes.
So
question.
It's a little hard to hear back here. So
is it?
The microphone
or? Okay. Yeah. And the people who are saying what you came to hear are sitting closer to you, so I think that will help. So anything else before we begin? Okay. So which one of you wants to start?
Francis.
You
yeah,
all Francis. Francis? Okay.
Okay. Should we just give people a chance to sit down? Want to sit
over? Okay. She doesn't want
to
sit.
Okay. So, do you have the microphone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You want to stand up? Or?
Yes,
okay.
I do indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to use the microphone just in case. Is that all right? Can I be heard? Yes? Okay. Well, we've heard a lot of thank yous already, so let me add my own thank you for the invitation to come here and present our book to the organizers, Luann and her colleagues. I think it's quite important that at least three of us were able to come here. And unfortunately, the budget, I understand, does not or did not allow for some of our other colleagues to travel to attend this panel. But I do want to sort of emphasize that there are a fair number of us, and you only see three of us represented. The original panel, for example, includes Audrey Kobayashi from Queens, Howard Ramos from Dalhousie, Melinda Smith from the University of Alberta. And in addition, one of the original members of our group was Peter Lee, formerly from the University of Saskatchewan. My role is sort of to put this book into a context, the context being the study of racism at the university, which for many people is an oxymoron because it doesn't exist. I mean, we know universities are hallowed institutions, and such a thing as racism, of course, doesn't take place. So to put it in context, we didn't all jump in to do a book on racism at the university. I had been interested in the topic of race and racism much earlier, largely through my initial interests and continuing research interests in Caribbean studies. But it wasn't until 1974 that I did presumably the first study of racism in Canada. I've never heard of any other. And that was an attitude study, testing people's attitudes towards then people of color. It was a very interesting experience, one that I don't wish on any of you. It concluded that racism, especially towards blacks and indigenous people, was alive and well in the attitudes of Canadians. Now, what was interesting was the reaction to it. The reaction to it was, what, racism? What is this all about? That's in the US, that's not here. This is the kind of research that professors do in their ivory towers, stuck away from the realities of life, usually some incomprehensible stuff. This largely negative response actually stirred me on. I think it would have stirred on anybody. The moment somebody says your work is not only not important, but that you made up some of the data, well, that is a real challenge that one has to disprove pretty quickly. So along with my colleague Carol Tatter, who was then director of the Urban Alliance on Race Relations here in Toronto, one of the earliest anti-racist movements that was founded here, I think it still is in existence, but it doesn't seem to do very much anymore. We started to look at what it has been called institutional racism. And our first edition of The Color of Democracy, Racism in Canadian Society, was published in 2004. It was written primarily as a text and was widely used in many Canadian universities. All told, there were four editions of it. I think it was probably the first comprehensive text on racism that was published in Canada, largely because of the positive reception to this work. We went on to research and write on areas of institutional racism in the media, in the justice system, racial profiling, the arts, etc. We came to the point where we were almost out of institutions. And finally, we turned our attention to our own workplace, the university, the site of wisdom, learning, the traditions of history, and the place where learned professors even taught the future leaders of industry and government. So this was a natural, but it took us quite a while until we decided to do a project on the university. Again, there was some surprise. Racism at the university, well, yes, we had heard of a few incidents and issues as racialized populations at the university began to become more numerous. But surely their professors weren't racist. I mean, that is just outlandish. In fact, these incidents that we heard sort of reported almost in as a form of gossip were very real, and quite a number of people suffered great indignities as a result, but kept quiet. So round about the same time, moving on in the narrative, there were some major incidents involving racism at Queen's University. Again, a very elite and august institution in this country. I was asked by the Senate of the university to come in as a consultant to look at the problems, and subsequently a report was written. Now, although its title was Systemic Racism Towards Faculty of Color and Aboriginal Faculty at Queen's University, published in 2003, it became known then as now, and very unfortunately, as the Henry Report. The Henry Report became rather notorious, particularly on the campus of Queen's University. It split the campus into two factions. It split the faculty into two factions. Those who agreed with its findings and those who were totally and completely in denial and who criticized every aspect of it, including, again, that I had, in fact, made up some of the data. I actually didn't collect the data. I used data that was collected by an equity group at the university. So this was sort of a landmark in terms of looking at one of Canada's major universities and finding that there was systemic disadvantage. And of course, one of my colleagues, Professor Dewar, was a teaching member at Queen's University at this time, and certainly knows this history from a personal experience. Although there was very little data, we turned to a few of our colleagues who had begun to experience and research racism and asked for contributions based largely not so much on research but in terms of their own experience. And an edited book that Luann mentioned earlier, Racism at the Canadian University, Demanding Social Justice, Inclusion, and Equity, published in 2009, came about. The contents of this book, and it was a book that was fairly well received. There were, again, some fairly notable writers involved. And the context of the book convinced us that the problem with it was that we were relying on individual experiences of a few people. There was no data. There was nothing to analyze. Or very, very little data done on this topic, and of course, especially not disaggregated data. So at that point, or maybe a little later, we began to make plans to conduct research, to go deeper, as we say today. And we were able to convince a number of really the best known critical race theorists in Canada to join us. And that is how the group of seven in this instance came about. We were extremely fortunate all of our colleagues who were themselves excited by the project were interested in doing it, and we went ahead and planned it. We each of us conducted research on the topics that were of most interest to us. And for example, many of us, all of us almost, conducted interviews in terms of the issues that we wanted to study. Many of us, several of us, were looking specifically to interview people, faculty of color, who were willing and able to share their experiences in an interview. But we also were fortunate enough to secure the cooperation of two scholars who are basically quantitative sociologists, and that was Howard Ramos from Dalhousie and Peter Lee from the University of Saskatchewan, both very well known in terms of their specific disciplines. And they, in fact, were responsible for the large-scale survey that we also used in the equity myth. And Peter Lee did a separate sort of study of income disparities, which is the basis of one of the chapters. And so we organized a cooperatively written book. This is really different from an edited book because we all sort of wrote it together. Everyone wrote their specific selections, their specific chapters, but all of us read everything and all of us criticized, commented, suggested changes, revisions, etc. So it was a cooperatively written tome. Now, writing a book like that is not without its difficulties, and I'm not going to get into the difficulties, but obviously, when you get a group of people together, there are bound to be differences. However, I think in the long run, we were able to overcome whatever piddling problems we really had and produced this book. Now we are 2 years later, and the book has been very well received and reviewed, as a matter of fact. It has been disseminated into government departments and both provincially, federally, municipally, etc., where decision makers sit, and especially in the hierarchy of university management. The book was sent by our publishers to, I think, every president of every major Canadian university, and it has gotten around. I find it hard to say as I'm so much part of this, but I think it is a truly important book in the history of social relations in Canada. And I'm very, very pleased and gratified as a scholar to have helped make this work possible. So that's a bit of the background. But let me just conclude this section of my little talk, and I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. We are thinking of a second edition. So if anybody is interested in that, that's an idea that we have recently begun to work on. So I think I will end here for the most part, but there's one thing I'd like to bring to your attention, but I think I'll perhaps save that for the discussion, and that is that a recently reported research done by Universities Canada which used a survey technology methodology is available now online, and it came out I think just a month ago, and it's a survey of most of the major universities in Canada. And the interesting thing about it, and I have some information I will share with you if we have time later, is that its findings almost replicate ours, almost word for word. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it totally confirms the findings of the equity myth. So I'll leave it there for the moment.
Okay, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
At the back? Great. So I'd like to add my thanks as well by, you know, the thanks that friends have started, my thanks to Lewin for organizing this, for Ivis for all the wonderful work that you've done to put the event together. And, you know, I like to thank everyone in this room. When I look around, I see many people who in many ways have contributed to the equity myth in terms of conversations I've had with colleagues across this campus. And, you know, I think I'm looking forward to our discussion because I think many of you will also have things to add to the research that we've done. So I'm thankful for everyone for coming, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts on the kind of questions that we're all grappling with, and that is how to work towards an anti-racist university. I wanted to follow up on what Frances is talking and started us thinking about by reflecting on the achievements, but also kind of thinking about the challenges that we face, since the equity myth has been published. And so in terms of thinking of the achievements, I want us to take us back to something that a number of people have mentioned, Sheila and Lewin and Frances, that about data. And in some ways, the story of the equity myth is a story of data. As Frances talked about, was one of the things that we felt was after racism in the Canadian universities was published was that there were many case studies on racialization in universities. And when we talked about our individual case studies, what often was said was, oh, well, that's Queen's. Oh, well, that's Brock. Oh, well, that's, you know, this university. And what it led us to think about was that what we really needed to have was a national study. But in carrying out that national study, one of the things that, you know, we very quickly came to thinking about was what data is available and what data do we want to generate. When we started, we were much more ambitious, and I don't know if Carl or Frances remember this, but our initial meetings were, we were talking about including student and staff experience. And as we started to look at our methodology, we found that because there was so little data on any experience, that part of what we needed to do in, you know, as we were writing up our SHRC application was to really think about how we're going to generate data. And so we narrowed it to faculty experience. But, you know, partly I want us to think about that because that's one of the changes that we're now in. One of the things that, you know, we were struck by was that while we, you know, expected universities to publish data, and under the federal contractor program, they were supposed to publish data, that even data on things like, you know, what's the percentage of, at that point, the category was visible minorities in Canadian, in a particular university, was very difficult to parse out. But part of the challenge of also the data was that broad-based data was not necessarily helpful because one of the things that broad-based data does is hide differences. So at that point when we were beginning the study, we were very aware of that there may be more representation of, again, I use a category from that period, visible minorities in sciences. But is that there for social sciences and humanities? And so thinking about these questions, we really quickly started to hone and say that what we really wanted to do, what we really needed to do, was to think about how we were going to generate national data on looking at racism in Canadian universities. And there, you know, I would say is one of the achievements of the book and one of the things that I think has subsequently evolved with the publication of Equity Myth was the kind of broad-based data that that you know we were able to generate, data on representation, and here we, you know, use data from university websites, but StatsCan data, and then in order to try to get down to some of the nuances that, you know, this broad data isn't allowing us to actually look at some of the more particular things about different departments, faculty, was Frances. Very labor-intensive work of taking particular universities and using their websites to identify and see if we could see what the percentage of representation was. One of the other things that we did was, you know, looked at the experiences of Indigenous faculty and faculty of color, and again, the kind of, you know, the labor-intensive focus groups and interviews that took place across Canada and Canadian universities. And then a survey that was also done, which was the first national survey of faculty experiences, looking at what universities are doing in terms of policies. That was part of my responsibility, was again kind of that broad-based assessment of what are the policies that are actually there and how are they effective. And so part of the success of this was not just that we were able to document racism at different levels and the patterns across universities, but I think we also created we created an awareness of the importance of data, and one that University of Canada and CAUT and other institutions have followed to try to start to continue to document those experiences. And so that, to me, I think is one of the things that I'm really struck by in terms of the achievement of the equity myth and the impact it's had. In terms of the success, I want to also quickly talk about a couple of things before I move to the challenges. I think one of the things that I'm personally really rewarded with the response to the equity myth is by racialized faculty and students. The number who've come up to me who've said, thank you for this study, this actually records my experiences, my life, things that, you know, were very difficult to raise awareness of, and now we've got a documentation of this pattern across many universities, all universities in Canada. And that to me is like, was why I think we all did this work and has been particularly rewarding. I think the other part that has been very rewarding is how it's been used by those who are putting forward equity on campuses, administrations, to think about EDI and think about how to take that forward. So those are all, to me, very rewarding aspects of what's happened in the last 2 years. But having said that, I think there are a number of challenges that remain. And some of the challenges is around data, and some of the challenges are around what Lewin had asked us to think about and what's been taken up and what hasn't been taken up. So I think one of the challenges is around thinking of intersectionality. Because we were so focused on getting the overall pattern in universities, we were rarely able to say, how are these patterns different for racialized women, for those who are part of LGBT communities, for those who are differently abled. I think that is one of the challenges that we face moving forward, and really thinking again, how do we move that discussion so we have that more nuanced understanding of intersectionality? Related to intersectionality is also another challenge that I think we are facing, and that is we have broad-based data on, now that the categories move to racialized members who are racialized. But again, it's an aggregate data that hides important differences. One of the things that we weren't able to tease out was the difference between experiences of Indigenous faculty and those who are racialized as others. And, again, I think as we're getting more Indigenous faculty into universities, that's a really important question, is, what are the patterns, how are those patterns differently, and how do we develop more nuanced policies and responses to address those kind of differences? And then related to that is the disaggregation of data around Black experience. One of the things that, again, we weren't able to do, and I think is a real important challenge that is in front of us, is to really think about the Black experience in universities, both as students, and I'm going to come back to that, but as faculty, and to think critically about anti-blackness and the way in which anti-blackness is reflected in the university. I think part of the challenge that we have right now is that there are some groups within the category of those racialized as other who are less represented than those who are also less represented. And we don't want to flatten it out. The importance is actually to develop then ways that we can identify those groups that are more marginalized than perhaps other of us who are racialized. And that's where an attention to anti-blackness, I think, is one of the critical things that universities are facing. Another challenge that I think we're also facing is thinking about the student experience. It was one of the things initially that we were hoping to do and weren't able to. And yet and that remains a real gap of how students of color are actually experiencing the university, how black students are experiencing the university, how indigenous students. In terms of first, as Carl's work is looking at the rate of success. Are these students graduating with the same at the same rate as other students? And if not, we know that this is a real serious problem, and a problem that goes both within universities and beyond, because it's also about access to universities, income, being able to continue juggling part-time jobs. But there are also very important things that happen within the university of, what happens in the classroom, who gets additional assistance if they need assistance on a paper, who gets judged for needing assistance on a paper, who, someone was telling me, who's on a petitions committee at York, that the vast majority of petitions come from those who are racialized minorities. What's leading to these students having to petition? So there are all sorts of things that I think that we really need to look at if we're really to look at racism in the university, and part of that is to think about student experience. And then undergraduate, but also graduate experience. As my colleague Melinda Smith says, that leaky pipeline, which shoots out water in students as you go through. How do we address who gets to graduate school? What happens in graduate school? What is that experience in graduate school? So that, I think, is one of the challenges that we're also facing. And then the last challenge that I want to talk about is, I think for me, it's rewarding where equity myth has been taken up. But when Lewin asked to reflect where it hasn't been taken up, I think there's a major area that wasn't taken up. So universities are responding to thinking about how to make universities more inclusive, and that's how to bring people of color into universities. But we're not thinking about what happens to them when they get here. And we're particularly not, I don't think there's been as much of a response to thinking about issues that we used to call climate issues. But if we think about them more critically, and that was part of the contributions I had to Equity Myth, our policies on harassment and discrimination. And one of the things I documented was our policies on harassment and discrimination. We look across universities and talk to those who are implementing these policies. There are a number of reasons why these policies are not effective in dealing with particular cases of harassment, discrimination, and climate when it comes to those racialized as minorities. We haven't had a discussion of how to make those policies more effective. That's one area that I think has not had much take up. And yet when talk to people about the equity myth in different universities, one of the first things they're telling me is about the kind of ways that the climate of the university is set up to exclude them, to marginalize them, the forms of harassment that they face, and the ways they feel that that harassment gets mobilized to real patterns of discrimination. So I think that is one of the challenges that really, hasn't been taken up with the equity myth, and one that we need to take moving forward. So on that, I'm going to end. And, you know, I look forward to hearing everyone's comments and, you know, also things that they would have to add on thinking through these questions of making the university more inclusive.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me. And it's nice being a group of, part of the group of seven. thanks, Francis.
You're not that famous.
Well, I was just thinking the next thing for Equity Myth, too, maybe is we all have to do a piece of artwork.
No, this makes us so Canadian, you know, after all. No one would also understand it. I want to engage you with a discussion about what I've learned, and some of the things I've learned, and some of the things I've been thinking through and thinking of since participating in the Equity Myth. And of course, some of my work earlier, even before the Equity Myth came out, has been to reflect on my space in the university, my role in the university, and some of the things I've had, the ways in which I've engaged the university, engaged students in the university. But overall, I always wanted to think, it's not just about the individual faculty member, the individual students that we're talking about. We have to start thinking about the institution as a whole and the societal structure that informs what's going on. So also want to so I want to start off with Don Cherry. This is the first opportunity to talk publicly. And it's not so much one. I've listened to every media presentation, discussion, and he's been interviewed, re-interviewed, et cetera, et cetera. And everyone looks at Don Cherry and what Don Cherry has said. But very rarely do we go back to what about the institutions that created Don Cherry and how these institutions continue to keep these notions of who's considered a Canadian and who's not considered a Canadian. And how the society, through its culture and the cultural ways in which we operate, reinforces that Canadian and non-Canadian. So it's ever so often we get these pronouncements from others who are constantly telling us about who is considered. So when we think of Trudeau's pictures, and everybody started talking about again, Trudeau, but nobody asked the question, what about the institutions that created him and what the institutions that continue to keep him in place, that idea in place, and what about the institutions that continue to have these things happening right now in the 21st century, in these years, still having those things. And so I start in those ways because it was instructive to me that Trudeau's images also got very international, large international responses. And, you know, I was called from BBC England, who were interested in these things. And also, you keep wondering, but it's not, if we continue to just look at these individuals and not constantly thinking about how much our society has not changed, despite the diversity, then we have to do some work beyond just simply doing these interviews and reading Equity Myth and so forth. I say all that to say that the university sits in this kinds of society, and therefore the university is not immune to these kinds of issues that we are constantly seeing. So the black body on the university campus is also going to be questioned whether he or she belongs there, as in Ottawa, as in University of British Columbia. And we're going to constantly also get the question of faculty members using the N-word, as in Western University, and the student having to do something about it and report it. And then the university also Remember, there's such a thing as academic freedom, and remember, there's other things as freedom of speech and all this, and the university is supposed to be the hub of all this. So when we think of the equity myth, we cannot just think of the interviews we did and what and that. We have to think about the university in 21st century, 2019, in a context where all these things must be addressed. And frankly, the university, it sits at the cuffs or the center of trying to unpack this. I constantly think of what the university does also with the land acknowledgement, beyond just saying it. How much are we moving and thinking about those things with regard to rewriting the history of Canadian history? To start there, and we, you know, the statement, you know, the understanding of the context also is going to be influenced by where you start. And therefore, if we're going to do this work and think of what the equity myth can do, then we're going to have to start thinking of the larger structure. So it's in that context, then, that we have to understand and engage in the discussion today about the some of the evidence. What's interesting is how much Canada as a society, and what we were trying to do when, in some cases, we tried to get data on faculty members. Many universities might not keep or don't keep data on faculty, and those who do sometimes would not have data disaggregated other than visible minority. And by the way, I always remember that the UN has asked that we cease using that term. But so why don't we keep data, and why don't we keep data on race? I'm always interested in when Justin Trudeau said, this is 2015, when he had when he was asked about his cabinet. 2015, and we write about it, and we talk about these things with regard to the number of women in parliament, etc., etc. But we never go the next step. We never talk about the diversity, and when we talk about diversity, we never go the next step to. Sorry about that.
Sorry.
We can probably hear you.
Okay.
No, I think the mic's working now.
Are you hearing me? Are you hearing me now? No. Okay. Just a sec. We're going to get the batteries. I always think it's my practice of equity, if a mic is available, I should always use it. So,
does anybody have any AA batteries with them? We have AAA, but not AA.
I've got one.
Do you?
Well, you know, one sometimes works. It's not good for the device, but...
Anybody else got their mouse with them?
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Oh,
is there a mouse? There must be a mouse here. Book on science publishing.
Starting narrator. Narrator dialogue. Exiting narrator.
Pardon?
I'll go in the middle. Just go in the middle.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or over there.
Or over here. Okay. Thanks, Ramai. Let me go back.
Okay, great.
Got it.
Are you hearing? Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Loud and clear.
So I wanted to make the point about going beyond just gender, because Ina made the point. Ina made the point about intersectionality. And what I've seen and observed over the past time I've been doing some work here is the difficulty in really thinking intersectionally with gender, race, disability, and so forth. And so I keep wondering, how is it that there's a difficulty in seeing those intersectional relationships? Because we tend to always think in parallels. You're black, and that's it. Then you're a woman, etc. But it's moving towards that I think we need to engage much more productively. And we're doing some work here, and I think York stands out on this, in doing the work that we do with regard to affirmative action and then affirmative action representation on hiring committees. And we know we're doing the unconscious bias training. I always quote a colleague and friend who is from England but now is in Canada. And there's something to be said about, yes, unconscious bias, but it becomes too much, as Shirley Tate says, has become too much a magic bullet for organizations, including universities, in the face of the continued occurrence of racism. It is the acceptable form of racism, the phrase that a majority of white sector feels comfortable with using and discussing to describe itself, unconscious bias. It is neatly addressed by a 10-minute online training course, she writes, with a multiple-choice assessment offered to all new staff in universities across the UK, which embrace equity, diversity, and inclusion. And so she's asking, beyond just simply these unconscious biases, and again, I see unconscious biases housing the consciousness of race and so forth, again, in the person, and not thinking about how the institution, through policies and programs and activities, reinscribe the particular biases. And sometimes it's that which we need to get at. The other thing that we're doing in a number of universities, we're having we're looking at the necessary kind of training. But beyond hiring, what about TNP, tenure and promotion? are those people on those committees? Because remember, one of the important things is not just hiring, is retention and promotion. Therefore, we need to start thinking, how are we going to get this university to move? Again, this is not simply, and I'm hoping that the equity myth is not just a matter of a good reference book that people will continue to do, but I'm hoping that it will help spur us on to changing the culture of the university. And yes, the university doesn't stand outside of the society, as I said, so ultimately want to change the society, but it's important to move towards that. Data has come about over and over and over again, and we keep coming into that, and we can use data. But how we use data beyond just simply the aggregate, the importance is the disaggregated data. And in going towards disaggregated data, we have to be prepared to disaggregate race and also come to terms with the position of some groups in that racial group not getting access the way they should. It's heartening from my perspective to hear universities, I hear people talk about anti-black racism. But what does it mean? And how are we able to engage it? And the other things that one to raise it, the other statement or question will be, what about? You know, what about this group? What about this group? And yes, what about might be an important question, but at the same time, we need to also think about how are different groups experiencing life as Canadian, and how is race operating in their lives? And so the university now, if we're going to move towards the kinds of equity that we talk, not equality, equity that we talk about, then we need to start thinking about looking at in the group as discrete groups, paying attention to their historical relationship to the society and how we must address those things. We have to also think about, and we haven't done this enough, is staff experience, you know, alluded to this, beyond just simply faculty. Because sometimes it's the staff who have those first relationships with students, with people applying for jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And we tend to, and York, I'm not talking York, but I'm talking generally, very often when we're thinking of moving towards equity, we hardly pay attention to that. One of the things that, I'm going to end with this point, one of the things I'm continually concerned about is racialized youth and their place in accessing education and the outcomes. What struck me when, and I did a number of the interviews from the East to the West, and what struck me when I met racialized faculty members, whether they were South Asians, Asians, or African background, many of them in the universities were of immigrant background. I do some work, and since then, I've done some work with the Black and Latina engineering group in the U.S. And what it strikes me when this is a national conference that I've gone to twice, and many of the people who come to that conference who are of African background or African American or Latina Americans, many of them are of immigrant background. We have to question, how is it that their immigrant background? And it should not be surprising that for racialized group, it seems as if eventually being thought of Canadian and seen as Canadian is much, much more difficult than the white person. And so therefore, the response to racism has something to do with their representation. So we have to start thinking, how are we going to change? Because Many of these kids are currently growing up in Canada. Many of them are going to be, we're going to have to help them get into the pipeline in order to have the diversity of faculty. So therefore, universities will have a role to play in starting to think through and helping us think through that whole idea of seeing racialized people as Canadians and as people whom we're going to want on our university campuses, eventually becoming the professors. And especially we're going to have to start thinking of what we're going to consider fit from here. You know, ever so often I think of the whole notion of how somebody fits into the faculty and how that word is used. So some of those things would be some of the things we have to think through. I want to say, I know I said that was going to be my last one, but one other point I wanted to make. What struck me as I was doing the interviews and is how do racialized faculty members engage university once they're here? And I came up with four different ways in which they engage university. One, they can be compliant, simply do as expected. And those who are compliant will say, well, you did not qualify, therefore you're just not going to make it. That's racialized faculty I'm talking about. Or they can be complicit. But remember, these are not necessarily exclusive. But these are some of the ways I see them engaging. Complicit insofar as they perpetuate the white structure of university because they see it as that which enabled them to get in. They were able to make it, therefore everybody else should be able to make it. So there's no changes. It's also important to say that as we move and try to get universities to be diverse, and we're going to try to get racialized faculty members, it also means that we have to think about how much they're going to have help and enable the kinds of changes that we want in the system. One of the other group I think of is critical participants. Those critical participants are very critical, but they also understand they have to meet the expectations. And so they play this kind of a juggling role, working hard at the same time, be critical. Because if you do not make it, therefore you might be out. The idea is that you also want to prove that you are appropriate to be in there. And the whole idea of the imposter syndrome that students talk about is something that they're very conscious of and work at. And then there's the activist. And the activist, you wonder how long will the activist survive challenging the university, given some of these things. And some of those ideas, I think, are things to think through. And I'm very intrigued with how racialized people eventually become the kinds of faculty members and eventually administration. Oh yeah, one last one, because we have to think of administration too, and not just faculty. Thanks very much. I look forward to the discussion.
Yes.
Position on society's other institutions, It itself is utterly unaffected by this process. It's an invaluable work for anyone interested in and working on issues of racial inequity. It's an invaluable research, partly also because it shows how mechanisms of systemic racism are precisely perpetuated through the kinds of knowledge that's been produced in the university by the academy. But the book is also a tool for transformation of the university, partly through the ongoing conversations that it can generate. And I think that the idea behind today's event is precisely to engage in this process, potentially of creating a counterculture within this university and engaging in a constant conversation about the salience of racial inequities and the progress also that that can be done. And it is also, as a recently hired racialized faculty member experiencing the university, for the past 3-4 years, navigating it, it's been an incredibly precious resource to have. Though I need to say, of course, it should be a precious resource for anyone working in this environment that has been historically shaped by racialization processes, not just by racialized faculty members. So, I came to the Canadian University, and that's, I'm trying to make them, brief because I know we only have 15 minutes. But I came naively thinking that institutional practices and cultures in spheres of power in, an elite institution, such as the university, would sharply differ from the place I come from and I've studied these processes, from, a very colorblind, abstract, universalist ideology endorsed in France and revealed in the absence in most higher education institutions in France of mechanisms advocating equity and inclusivity. So in fact, in France, naming racism is already viewed by many gatekeepers of these institutions as a way of nurturing racism and systemic racism. So denouncing it is really part of the problem, according to this colorblind, highly institutionalized, highly powerful ideology endorsed. So there's no sociology of race, no sociology of racism really in place, let alone one which would, study racism from, within the institution, this so-called mutual objective scientific knowledge production thing. So, I was struck by the continuities, by the similarities that I've read about and that I've experienced to some extent, highlighting as the authors show the global processes behind it, the historically rooted whiteness of organizational cultures, and the systemic racism that part of that transcend this national specificity. So I think, as Francis was mentioning, that you're thinking of a second edition, we should be thinking about translating this book in French and teaching it, really, because it would be hugely helpful to colleagues there who are trying to produce similar work with a very, very strong ideological, institutional resistance to, really getting that. So very strong for them to, as you're saying, go deeper precisely and produce, have data. Number one thing is really to say how this work, again, I think the conversation should be had beyond national boundaries. And also, a second point is that, as you were mentioning, the conversation should be had across all members of the institution. My work, as one was saying, was on students only. That was actually one of its shortcomings. But, I was struck by the similarities in experiences by the students. The idea, the experience of being viewed at best as a guest, at worst as an intruder in an institution that, has historically, not welcomed, racialized students. So that's one of the very striking similarities of being constantly the outsider within the institution. The recurrent experience of not being viewed as learners or students, but as primarily as members of their community. So, you know, a representative who have to speak up about their experience of being Muslim, being a black, wearing the veil, even in times of oral examinations, for example. So I think that it would be very interesting to pursue this conversation and to see what are the experiences of our black students here, our white graduate students, our racialized students generally, our indigenous students, and to see how, because of their accentuated, amplified status of vulnerability, you know, very often comments, racist comments can come from teachers, they can come from administrators, so they come from the very persons, the very gatekeepers, who will later on either hire them as research assistants, you know, hire them as doctoral students or not. So that, you know, would add to or would complement this intersectional perspective which you're thinking of you know, further exploring. And ironically, in fact, and I will end on that, and then I have a set of specific questions. You know, very often my respondents were thinking of achieving upward mobility via outward mobility by coming to Canada, by becoming members of, you know, Canadian university. And so that in that sense, they hoped their, you know, this suspicious white gaze would probably be, you know, less intense in a country that has, you know, been very successful at presenting itself as committed to diversity, to multiculturalism, mm-hmm. and these have very effectively circulated across the Atlantic, and so the Canadian context is really viewed as a very favorable, very anti-racist context for many of the, you know, the respondents I've interviewed. And then, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think we could perhaps discuss in the few minutes that we have is the ways in which moving forward, how can we make the mechanisms in place to fight for equity more effective, more visible, more accessible? One comment I have is on entry points. You know, when you become a member of York, the mechanisms, the offices, the policies are not really, for example, part of your orientation day. You know, in your orientation day, you're being given a range of tools about how to become an excellent researcher, an excellent teacher. You are given a talk on mental health from very individual level perspective. But you're not really, you know, directed to, you know, equity services, equity policies. We don't see a commitment when we go to this orientation stage to, you know, precisely decolonizing or the institution and so we go to this orientation, you know, what we get in this orientation is a very colorblind, very new race neutral perspective on what the institution really does. The other thing, you know, I was curious to hear, you more perhaps on the role of also departmental chairs, coordinators of programs. Do they receive special training on equity? Do they receive them regularly? Should this training be given by members of the York community? Those who are already committed to equity issues may, you might think already be overworked, you know. So outside of your community, do we have, regular training for those who play a key role, you know, in specific departments? And I say that because I've been in conversations about, for example, possible changes in the curriculum, precisely to make the curriculum more inclusive. And so what I found is that the fight for equity very often ends when the one for academic freedom begins. So, as you were rightly pointing out, this notion of academic freedom is viewed, again, from a very colorblind, race-neutral perspective. So how can we really make, how can we make progress when, we have, our colleagues committed to equity who say, you know, but we can't do anything because of that academic freedom. We know that. So that's one of the challenges that I find. How can we, pursue this anti-racist fight and at the same time not do anything to, you know, the racial privileges that come with some of these notions. I have many other comments. Maybe one last one because I see we're running out of time. The shift to the organizational culture. And I'm thinking, what can be the practical strategies through which we can, you know, change the organizational culture from within? So, you know, one of the thoughts, through conversations with colleagues, one of the things that, you know, I've seen, which could have potential, is to precisely have ongoing events as opposed to, you know, one-time events, ongoing events about experiences of racialized faculty members, the experiences of, we can talk about marginalized epistemologies, marginalized knowledge. So what are the tools to change the organizational culture? and then maybe one last thing about the fragmentation of equity policies and committees and offices in the institution. I think it is certainly very important to decentralize the fight for equity, but how effective the overall structure worked to meet equity on campus. So, you know, to add to that, York is a very internally disparate place in terms of availability of equity-related services. And so, you know, for example, I'm thinking Glendon. The Glendon campus has a unique challenge. Some of its members face strong physical linguistics barriers to accessing equity services, equity policies, and offices that exist at Keele. So what can be done to have more, you know, effective policies on that? So I think I will...
We are running out of time. Thank you. Clearly, we need more time for this conversation. And so maybe we can think of this as the beginning of a conversation rather than the end of it. I'm going to suggest that we take a few more minutes and maybe a little bit past 3:30. If people need to leave at 3:30, we will certainly understand. Let's take a few minutes, perhaps until 3:40, to have a bit of a discussion. Can we pass the mic around?
Yes.
Yeah. So, do you want to respond, the three of you, first to Shirin's comments, or do you want
let's
to take questions?
Other people, because we may
other
run
people
out of
speak?
Time.
Okay.
I think it's important.
Okay. So, do you have questions, comments? Yes.
That was great. Great presentation. I'm not actually expecting any answers, but maybe something for us all who are interested in equity issues at universities. We have a university academic plan being developed as we speak, and unfortunately, it's almost the flip. Is there any way you can intervene in that process to entrench some of the suggestions? I think you're working on into that to push additional addressing some of these, especially.